So then, to reiterate, this Sunday and the two ones following, I'll be offering kind of a framework talk that conveys some basic teachings of the Buddha in the realm of doubt, and then trying to make sure we have ample opportunity for discussion and sharing as well. So classically, the way I also want to preface this by saying that in preparing for this series, I have done a fair amount of research and reading, both in terms of the teachings of the Buddha and also case studies of some of the issues that have recently arisen that are, I think, worthy of our attention. In the teaching biz, we sometimes talk about having a course in the can, and so I have Dharma talks on doubt that I've given frequently in the past, and so I realized as I went back over my notes from before that really wasn't going to quite hack it in terms of the depth of presentation and discussion that I'm hoping we're going to have. I also came to realize as I was doing my reading and looking over my old notes and my reflections that taking up this subject sincerely and honestly can be a difficult and painful experience. Okay. The Buddha, in teaching about the nature of doubt, he said there are basically two dimensions to it. One is the object of doubt, and the other is the form of doubt. In terms of objects of doubt, the three classic ones are doubt of the teachings, doubting the Dharma itself, right? Doubting the teacher, the person who has taken upon her or himself to occupy the Dharma seat and share the Dharma, or doubt in oneself. In terms of the forms that doubt can take, there's also a range, or there is a range. The first is what has in various contexts been called noble doubt. That's the term that Sogyal Rinpoche uses in his book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Sometimes also called reasonable doubt, you know, sort of like the burden of proof a prosecutor has to carry to put somebody away for a crime, you know, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And that form of honest empirical inquiry is something that the Buddha actually recommended. There is a passage or a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. It's one of the more famous teachings of the Buddha on this subject when he was asked to come and give a discourse, share his teachings with a group of people, a kind of a spiritual community, a community of seekers called the Kalamas. And they had several different teachers come in and do their shtick, you know, talk about their cosmology and their worldview and what they thought practice ought to consist of. And so he came in and he started to do his teaching, and they said, well, wait a minute, you know, last week there was some other guy in here doing his thing, and what he said was totally different from what you're saying. And then the person before that said something totally different from both what you're saying and the other guy was saying. So who are we to believe? And essentially what the Buddha said was believe nothing. So in the discussions among academics as to whether or not, in fact, Buddhism is actually a religion, that's still a kind of a live topic, right? And it all goes to the question of how you define religion. Okay. If you define religion as there being a guy in the sky, you know, some kind of external deity, okay, and you define religion as having a code of beliefs that members, adherents have to swear to in order to be a member of that religion, then Buddhism is not actually a religion. It does not meet those criteria. So it doesn't have what we would recognize as something like the Nicene Creed in Christianity, for instance, which are basically, I believe these things to be true, right? Which is very importantly distinguishable from faith, which is very important in Buddha Dharma. And I'll kind of make clear that differentiation here in a moment. So in answering the question to the Kalamas, why should we believe you any more than we should believe anybody else? And he said, well, you shouldn't. He said, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reflection on reasons, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think this ascetic is our teacher. So for instance, just because somebody is charismatic, you know, is a gifted orator, is very good at convincing people of this. They said that's no grounds for spiritual inquiry or the development of your spiritual practice. But when you know for yourselves these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken in practice, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. So that's what he means by, you know, careful empirical inquiry. Test a teaching based on your own experience. This phrase was ehi patiko. Come see for yourself. Okay. So that form of doubt, not just taking something for granted because somebody with a lot of, you know, stripes on their shoulders or, you know, a high official in a religious institution tells you so, or because of charisma, or because they're a skilled logician. He said the only true test of whether something is so is your own experience. So that's noble doubt, a reasonable doubt. Second form of doubt is skeptical doubt. So, again, to make the distinction, the Buddha, you know, it's said overall over the course of his teachings, he said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering, suffering and the cessation of suffering. Actually, in his very earliest teachings, as conveyed to us in a translation and a commentary on, I think it was the Book of Eights by Gil Fronsdale. The title of the book is The Buddha Before Buddhism. His very earliest teachings before this institution of Buddhism, you know, all the sanghas and whatnot, came into being. He said, rather than saying, I seek, you know, cessation of suffering, I seek to know the causes of suffering and the cessation of suffering. He said, I come seeking peace of mind. Interesting, isn't it? Different take.
What was that again?
He said, going forth on my journey, on my path of inquiry, he said, what I was seeking is peace of mind. Yeah, right. Okay. Why does the mind feel distress? Why does the mind feel dissatisfaction? How can the mind open to, awaken to ultimate peace? That was the original nature of his inquiry. So when he says, you know, if your mind is feeling stressed, distressed, if you feel like you're living in a state of dissatisfaction with things as they are, then it's worth inquiring into why this is so. You know. And then he laid out, you know, pretty much the same teachings. You know, there is, we see the reality of the distressed mind. We see and feel and experience the reality of the dissatisfied mind. What brings that about? He said, in my explorations, I found it to be craving, wanting things to be different than they are. You know, craving and clinging to certain things, whether it was views and opinions, or sense desires, or religious rites and rituals, or the belief in a permanent and abiding self. When in fact, eventually it became apparent to me that none of those forms of clinging was going to bring peace of mind. And the only thing that was going to bring peace of mind was letting go of them all. And then he spoke of how that letting go can take place. You know, that once that realization has occurred, then you can develop the path of letting go. So what he said to the Kalamas and others was, come see for yourself. He said, if you wish to experience peace of mind, I encourage you to look at the cause-effect relationship between behavior and fruition, behavior and outcome, behavior and the effects of your behavior. Relationship between your speech and the effects of your speech. Relationship between your actions and the effects of your actions. And not only that, the relation between your intentions and your speech and your actions. Okay. Which of these things appears to you to have a wholesome outcome and which has an unwholesome outcome? So come see for yourself. Reflect on whether that's true in your own life. That if you have unwholesome intention and you utter unwholesome speech and take unwholesome action, it's going to have an unwholesome outcome. It's going to cause dissatisfaction, distress, and suffering for yourself or others. Look and see the times when you have been generous and kind, when your intention has been to alleviate suffering. Okay. Look at the relationship between that intention and the speech and the actions that flowed from it. Did in fact you find that led to peace of mind and to happiness? If on reflection in your own experience you have seen this to be the case, then try it. First is come see for yourself, and then is try it for yourself. Try living in this way and see if it has the effect of bringing you greater peace of mind and more freedom from distress. That is, and if you find that that is the case, okay, that when you that you do see that cause-effect relationship between intention and speech and action, and you seek to practice only moving on wholesome intentions, okay, then what will happen is that you will begin to develop faith in these teachings being true, being not just the Dharma, but your Dharma, the truth of your being, the truth of your existence. And if you discover this to be the case over and over again, what you are doing is laying the foundations for faith in the Dharma. Okay. Whether it's what's called the bright faith when you're going forth, or the verified faith based on experience over and over again. So, noble doubt, which can in fact, following his prescription here, lead to the arising of faith in the Dharma. If what he taught about the distressed mind and peace of mind turns out to be true for you. He said, if it doesn't turn out to be true for you, then it's not the basis for you to develop, you know, Dharma study and practice. If it does turn out to be true, then this way is worth looking further into. This path is worth exploring. This path is worth investing your energy and your interest in and seeing where it takes you. Any questions about that so far? Okay. Something else that comes up in looking at these issues is the question of what did the Buddha actually teach? Theravada Buddhism, Theravada meaning way of the elders, is based on texts of the first transcripts from the oral tradition into writing of what the historical Buddha is actually thought to have said. Okay. So roughly for the first 100 years or so after the Buddha's death, all of his teachings were transmitted only through oral tradition, okay, by monks who had exceptionally good memories and who had been trained. There were these teams of monastics who were each trained to learn certain of these discourses that the Buddha taught, and they would recite them on a regular basis. Okay. And that's how the Dharma was transmitted. Well, over the course of 100 years or so, memories started to get a little vague. It's like when you have an original carving, and then you make a copy of it, and then you make a copy of the copy. After a while, it becomes a little ragged around the edges. And so after around 100 years, they said, we better start writing this stuff down. And so they did so on ola leaves, and they carried these big baskets of leaves around with them. And these were the first texts of the Buddha's teachings. About 300 years after the Buddha died, and these books had been carried around, there were these successive councils of the Buddha's followers who were trying to keep pure the teachings of the Buddha. And then there arose, 300 years after the Buddha's death, the first Buddhist emperor, Ashoka. And he was a mighty warrior and monarch who actually united India for the first time into a country. And he also, after having fought these bloody wars, was aghast at what he'd done and learned of the teachings of the Buddha and took them up wholeheartedly and made them his life. And he made Buddhism the state religion of India 300 years later. And so he asked these monks, I know you all have been quibbling about, what the Buddha said and what the Buddha maybe didn't say. I really want this all to be, written down into a set of texts that we can go forward with in the future, so we'll really know what the true Dharma is. Well, by that time, there was a pretty big schism that had occurred within the Buddha's followers. And they were fussing about things like what the Buddha actually said or what the Buddha actually maybe didn't say. So there began to diverge these different Buddha Dharma traditions arising out of that. The original Theravada, and then this other group that came to be called the Mahayana. And the Theravada tradition stayed in India, and then it eventually became the dominant tradition in Southeast Asia. The Mahayana tradition, principally differentiated by more emphasis on the role of the Bodhisattva, the semi-enlightened being who delays her or his own enlightenment in order to take rebirth, in order to help others become free. Also the view that lay people can become fully enlightened, whereas in the Theravada it tended to be that you had to become a monastic first. So anyway, they had these doctrinal differences. They also had different texts. In the Mahayana tradition, the Prajnaparamita Suttas, the teachings on perfection of wisdom. Okay, the first of those texts appears about 500 years after the Buddha died. And so then there was this quibbling about, well, did the Buddha really say that? And so some of the Mahayana said, well, he actually did, but you guys left it out of the Pali Canon. exactly the same stuff that went on with Constantine I. He's the first Christian emperor of Europe and Asia. And he, 300 years after Jesus died, he pulls these people together and say, all right, if Christianity is going to be the state religion, y'all better write down what Jesus actually said. And they did in the four Gospels. And then there is this fifth Gospel, the Gospel according to Thomas, that's just as authentic and has been verified historically to be so. But it's the only one of the four that found the spirit, the source of ultimate spiritual authority to lie within oneself, the Jesus in your heart, rather than the church. And so they decided we're not having any of that, so they left that out. And because it was the politics that was going on around figuring out what was going to go in the Bible. Same thing was going on with regard to writing down the teachings of the Buddha. There was a lot of politics at work. Okay? And that was because there were different factions within the Sangha. You know, the strongest faction was those who had been Brahmanic, you know, members of the Brahmin class, and the ones who had carried forth the Hindu religion prior to becoming Buddhists. So there are aspects of what's in the Pali Canon that read a lot like Hindu scripture. And some scholars are saying, well, you know, the Buddha probably didn't really ever say that. And so instead they've been studying ancient Chinese texts from the missionaries that went to China shortly after the Buddha died and before the Pali Canon was codified, and shared their teachings in China in a set of books called the Agamas. And so now it's really come more to the scholars who are doing some of the most interesting work now are reading the Agamas against the Pali Canon, against some Tibetan texts. And whenever they see them kind of coming together, that looks to them like it's more than likely what the Buddha said. So, noble doubt, skeptical doubt. Noble doubt invites deeper inquiry. Skeptical doubt is a different animal entirely. It's one of the five hindrances that arises when mindfulness is beginning to establish itself. You know, along with anger and lust and sloth and torpor and anxiety and restlessness and worry. In some ways, it's considered the most powerful one. Powerful, it becomes powerful enough, it can bring meditation to a halt. In this case, we're talking about skeptical doubt of the teachings. Okay. What's really going on with skeptical doubt? It can really stop you in your tracks. You know, what is there begin? It's a combination of thoughts of doubt along with suspicion. What's going on at this point is something that I call dueling doubts. Doubt in the Dharma only arises, or doubt in the teacher, or doubt in oneself, only arises once mindfulness has begun to establish itself. When people, you know, on a retreat or something say, oh God, you know, I don't know if this is for me. You know, I have all these raging emotions that are arising. I'm falling asleep all the time. And I really am not so sure if this stuff is really the truth. What do I mean by dueling doubts? When mindfulness becomes well-established, and whenever people start feeling the hindrances, it's really hard for me to get across them. No, it means this stuff is working, not that you're being defeated, you know, or not that you're getting bogged down. Okay. What's going on when mindfulness is well-established is that it begins to create doubt in the existence of a permanent and abiding self. So for most of our lives, you know, we talk about kind of neural pathways. For most of our lives, our notions of our understanding of ourselves has followed this one neural pathway that we've been trained over and over again to believe, which is that there is a self. There is an ego. I'm permanent, I'm here, you know, I'm just the same as I've always been and whatnot, and I, you know, I'm a little kid, I grow up, I get old, I die, but it's still me, right? And furthermore, if you belong to certain religious traditions, furthermore, that part of me is going to be reborn, or that part of me is going to go to heaven and be with God and Jesus. What mindfulness begins to do, it slows down and makes so microscopic our ability to attend to the mind. Though every once in a while, that particular neural pathway doesn't fire. It's what the neuroscientists call neuroplasticity. That every once in a while, the construction of our consciousness follows a different route. And when it does that, it looks over and says, huh, maybe there isn't a self. Maybe the Buddha is onto something, right? So it begins to create doubt in the belief in a permanent and abiding self. And when the mind is selfing, when the mind is creating self, the self says, I'm not having any of that, you know, because it sees it as a palpable threat to its own existence, and it is, you know. Mindfulness creates doubt in the belief in a permanent and abiding self. And in retaliation, or in self-protection, the self creates doubt in the Dharma.
Can you say that again, please?
Yeah. Right.
I'm just doubtful, yeah.
So, as mindfulness begins to work, you know, it's like drops of water in the springtime, you know, when the rocks warm up and the ice melts on the rocks and then water flows over them and the water drips down onto the frozen stream. It little bit by little bit, as it warms up, it starts to, you know, make a hole in the stream. It starts to melt away the ice until eventually the whole stream begins to get a little mushy, you know. Sokni Rinpoche, the Dzogchen meditation teacher, says, well, you know, and he's talking about, you know, he said, think of the three states of water, you know, as ice, as slush, as fluid water, you know, or as ice, you know, as water, and as a gas. He said, well, when the Dharma really begins to take hold, you are in the process of transferring from ice into water. But a lot of the times we find ourselves in the state of slush. It's like the belief in a self is softening, okay? But it's not the whole way there. It's not, hasn't reached liquid form yet, you know, and then on to sort of the eternal. So what's going on as mindfulness becomes better established and becomes stronger is it starts to become increasingly apparent that the possibility that there is no self that's constructed by the mind on a moment-to-moment basis is actually how things work. And the self, when it's being constructed, finds that very threatening because it's robbing the notion of self of power. And its final defense against mindfulness is to create doubt in the Dharma. Okay. That's the nature of skeptical doubt. It's the ego's last defense, you know. Don't believe this stuff because it's going to melt me into nothingness. You know, I'm melting. What have you done, you little girl? Throwing water on me. So anyway, it's kind of what's going on here, right? That's the power of the Dharma, and it's also the power of doubt, you know, of preventing you from being able to test your faith in the teaching of a not-self. And the most powerful, in some ways the most painful, is when your doubt in the teachings, if you're on the right path, you know, if the Dharma is really as it is said to be, is when you find yourself in a state of despair. Okay. Joseph Goldstein, in his book, One Dharma, he talks about, you know, he was spiritually raised, you know, when he first undertook the study of Buddha Dharma in Asia, and first in the Peace Corps in the 1960s, and then with various Buddhist teachers in the early 1970s going forward. He was very well grounded in the Theravada tradition. And then he also studied the Dharma with other teachers from other traditions, particularly the Vajrayana, Tibetan. He practiced with a lot of Tibetan masters. And came to realize that the Theravada and the Vajrayana which is some consider to be part of Mahayana tradition, really have considerably different views on some fundamental questions in the Dharma. Like, what is the nature of enlightenment? What does true peace of mind consist of? And how does one get there? You know, some really kind of fundamental things. So he writes, so 1,000 years ago, a great monk from Nalanda University named Atisha arrived from India to Tibet to help reestablish the purity of the monastic way of life. He was 60 years old when he arrived. And although he had planned to stay only 3 years, he remained there until he died at the age of 72. At one point, Atisha met one of the renowned translators of the Buddhist texts into Tibetan, who asked him how best to practice. Atisha replied, "You should find the essential point common to all teachings and practice in that way." So, in the West, and we have sectarianism and Buddha Dharma just like we do in any other great wisdom tradition. But we are saddled with something else in our culture as well, which is this notion of mutual exclusivity. Okay. Can't be a Catholic and a Unitarian at the same time. Can't be a Democrat and Republican at the same time. Okay. And the feeling is that you either follow this path and you follow it to the letter, or you're not being true to the Dharma. Okay, and there are some Dharma teachers that pretty much come from that place. Joseph Goldstein's not one of them. What he was saying is, look for what is genuinely skillful and useful in all the traditions. Okay, so he finds the bodhisattva path, the path of compassion and open-heartedness and service and emptiness, to be very powerful and very important, and an important complement to the teachings that are to be found in the Theravada view. He said there are going to be people in all these traditions who are going to say, if you do not wholly buy into one of these traditions or another, you are not practicing the two dharma. But going back to the time of Atisha, you know, what was being taught there is what Joseph basically teaches. What do you find common in all these traditions? One thing is the four ennobling truths and the Eightfold Path. They arise in all of them, even though they are spoken of in different ways. A feeling of having coming up on despair, and that's what Joseph is doing in terms of what's the true Dharma, right? When each of us finds ourselves coming up on a real deep doubt in the Dharma, a feeling can be like one of coming to the end of the road, nothing more in the teachings or practices that have benefit in your quest for the cessation of suffering, maybe a sense of hopelessness. Okay. Some means of approaching this, okay. Being mindful of what it is that's going on. How does it feel in the body when you feel this doubt? How does it manifest in thoughts and emotions? Is there fear and loneliness, isolation or worry that you followed a false path and can't find your way back? Simply being mindful is an important starting point, naming what's going on, naming the emotions. Seeking out teachings that specifically address strong skeptical doubt and how to work with it. It's something else to do. Examine other Dharma approaches that you think might address your needs, just as Joseph suggested doing. Not skipping lightly from one tradition to another, but exploring it deeply until you think maybe you've learned what you have, what there is to learn from that tradition at this point in time, and then comparatively experiencing another. Just be sure you follow the Dharma path as far as you feel you can before either taking a break or abandoning it altogether. It will always be your experience of what is called verified faith that keeps you on the path. Simply pay careful attention to when that verification occurs in your life, if indeed it does. And if it really feels like it's time to explore other routes of inquiry, the Dharma isn't going anywhere. It's always there waiting, and you don't start back at square one. You always build on what you already know. So as I said, next week we're going to explore more deeply what it means to doubt a teacher and what some of the causes of that are, what the effects of it are, and we'll see that the three forms of doubt actually intertwine in each other. And then the third week we're going to look at mostly in doubting oneself. Meanwhile, though, I would like to open the rest of the evening now to talk about these forms of doubt, noble doubt, skeptical doubt, despair, as they apply to the teachings. Do you have questions? Is there something in your own experience that resonates with something that I've said, something you'd like to share, something you'd like to know more about? So this is the time for that. Please.
Connecting what you said about yourself to points in other pathways that are similar. Just happened to be reading Thomas Merton. And Thomas Merton's idea of no self is pretty much letting Christ take over. And I thought, well, maybe that's an advantage, because if the ego is so defensive about no self, having a loving being take over might be easier. What do you think?
Yes. So the question about Thomas Merton's surrendering to Jesus, right? Okay. Similar teaching in 12-step programs, right? Surrendering to a higher power. The notion of letting go into a trusting spiritual environment. Interestingly, I'm doing a lot of reading of the works of Anilayo right now, including his recently published book on a practical guide to the practice of mindfulness meditation rather than a more scholarly inquiry. And especially having come out, I guess it's been over a year or so now, as gender fluid, one of the things I found actually fascinating and resonated with in Anilayo's writing in this book points out first that Pali is a gendered language, like the Romance languages, and that sati, or mindfulness, is feminine. And he said, instead of simply this practice of bare attention, he said, you can do mindfulness practice with neutral intent, it's nothing more than simply observing, like a security camera, or like Ajahn Chah used to say, there's no particular virtue in just sitting. He said, chickens can do that, What Anilayo said that really fascinated me is he said, it's really useful if you can imagine your mindfulness to be a kind female friend who has come to be with you and to help you see what is going on in your mind and what is going on in your heart of hearts. So it's really kind of similar in that way. It's like surrendering to mindfulness when it's practiced with a compassionate heart, okay, which seems very likened to what you were just talking about Thomas Merton's teachings being, that a trusting presence or a trusting field into which you can relax, into which you can give yourself over, without fear of harm. In Theravada Buddhism, there's this blessing that I sometimes chant, at the end of it, may there be every blessing, may all the devas protect you. And that understanding is that there is this sort of realm of consciousness, of super consciousness, that is generated by beings inhabiting the Deva realm, which is to say inhabiting this realm of support and open-heartedness and protection, okay? And that it can be very skillful to surrender to that, that that is in fact what the nature of mindfulness practice with a compassionate heart is all about. So I think they're very, very similar, in fact, to what you just described. Thanks. Thanks again. Please. All right.
Definitely have the insight of time about yourself, experience that. Took me 3 years of practice, mm-hmm. and then to go out into Rocky Mountain, Kodaro, stand in front of a mountain to really understand the teachings of Anyatapa. It's one thing to experience it in that secluded environment, and then it's another thing to come back home to the stuff that you have to deal with on a regular basis, to go to, you know, 9-to-5 job, whatever it is, rush hour traffic, and feel identified with that sense of self, dealing with all those issues.
Yes. Yes.
It feels harder to access that insight when you're just, you know, just on a day-to-day basis dealing with all the issues that you have to deal with. So, do you think that the sense of, or the realization of no self, does that stabilize more with more practice? Or what are your thoughts about accessing that on a regular basis?
So the question having to do with having had the experience of anatta, of not self, occur in a meditation retreat setting out in nature, but then finding that it's not so accessible when one comes back into daily life. Okay. And that the distinction between the two can sometimes, you know, cause to arise a little doubt in oneself, you know, so, well, maybe my practice isn't strong enough. Everything arises because of causes and conditions. One of the reasons that most people have an experience such as anatta, or satori as it's called in Zen, in retreat settings, is because retreat settings have been, and as they have been for the last 2,500 years in Buddha Dharma, the setting has been created to create conditions favorable for the arising of that insight. So first off, when we go to retreat, we take refuge in the Dharma, we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge in the Sangha. We co-create a place of safety and sanctuary where we promise each other we won't harm each other, we won't take each other's stuff, we won't hit on each other, we won't engage in unskillful speech, and we'll stay clear-minded. So we have created a safe environment for practice. Okay. And I can tell you it's different to practice the Dharma in a beautiful natural setting, such as the Rocky Mountains, than it is to practice it next door to an oil refinery. You know? Because the body feels safe, right? The air is clear. The view, you know, the surroundings are stunning. You know, they almost invite the mind to relax the activity that creates the separation between self and other, that creates the separation between oneself and nature. You know, it basically invites the spirit to free itself. Okay. And then, of course, if there are Dharma teachings going on at the same time, and so the mind is stimulated to think about these things, then these circumstances can all arise to result in having that kind of insight. That's why retreats are designed in the way that they are. That's why we take the vows that we do when we go on them. You know, because it makes it more likely that kind of insight will arise in this trusting, safe environment than in everyday life. You know, because there is this intuitive understanding that the construct itself has a role to play. You know, on the job, you know, driving your car or whatever, paying your bills, that it's a handy thing to have. It's just that's not all of who you are. And so when you're in that kind of safe and relaxed environment, it gives the mind permission to explore more deeply the possibility to play with the idea that the self is something that the mind does rather than who or what we are. So one of the things going home from retreat that the teachers always try to emphasize is that whatever experiences that you had were on the retreat were in part a result of the conditions of the retreat experience, the retreat setting. And that to expect that somehow you should be able to have the same kinds of experiences, the same kinds of insights after you go home is a source of dukkha, you know. It's creating unrealistic expectations for what your practice might hold or what your future might hold. Increases the chances if you sit a lot. You know, if you make sure that practice is a regular part of your day, because it habituates the mind. It allows it to hang out in that space on a regular basis, you know. But and then to be there for whatever happens. The memory of that experience of not self will not go away, you know. And so next time it occurs, you'll recognize it for what it is. Right, it becomes cumulative. Yeah, good, thank you. Please. Yes.
So if you're one that can, I guess, bring yourself to get to that point of knowing self and being able to practice on a regular basis, would that be an opportunity for you to focus on something like the Eightfold Path and just kind of build those types of things?
The understanding, you know, in Buddha Dharma traditions, by and large, is that the notion of self is simply an activity of the mind. It's kind of like in the Japanese iconography, Buddhist iconography of the full moon partially occluded by clouds. You know, that pure bright mind, the mind of no self is always there. It's always shining. Sometimes it's covered up, sometimes it's not. So on occasion, whether it's on retreat or elsewhere, when the clouds move away and there's this realization, wow, you know, the heart's still beating, the lungs are still breathing, but there's simply the awareness that the mind isn't selfing, right? A lot of spontaneous insights can arise at that time. Usually when some experience like that happens, it tends to be very quick, and then essentially what you're doing is remembering what that was like. It was like, aha. And so it kind of verifies your faith a little bit in these teachings. And so it becomes easier to contemplate the aspects of the Eightfold Path, for instance. It becomes easier to see them and how useful they are, because you see better than you were before where they're leading. Okay. Is that responsive?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good, thank you. Thank you. Okay, good. And there was a question back here.
Yeah, I was just curious, like, from a kind of building up the previous question, in seeking like a pragmatic approach, if you will, does it help to just try to release the thoughts of, you know, wanting to judge, not being overly attached, not resisting? Is that the kind of stuff that can be used, like, in the more pragmatic settings to kind of help us pursue the teachings of the Dharma?
So, say it again. I'm not quite sure I fully got the gist of it.
Yeah, I was just curious, like, in those day-to-day, like it was kind of being said, like, you're working a full-time job. And we're really trying to, like, again, seek out the teachings.
Yes.
Does things like letting go of judging, not being overly attached, choosing not to resist, are those the kind of things that, from like a pragmatic standpoint, you know, given the reality of stuff?
Yes.
Can those be the things that can help us teach in a more pragmatic
way? Letting go of judging, letting go, you know, can those be, absolutely. For many of us, however, what the first step is, And this is kind of the beauty of mindfulness is, oh, mind judging, okay. I should let go of judging. Owie, that hurt. So then you have those two things. You notice the mind judging, and then you judge yourself for having a judging mind, right? So step one is usually to see if you can knock off that second one. And so you see that happening. And then it's you're just back to say, oh, mind judging. You know, it's one of the things the mind does. So insofar as the practice of the Dharma is concerned, on the job or elsewhere, the problem, or the real issue lies not and whether you're noting the mind judging, it's what you do about it or don't do about it. So you can have a critical judgment of another person or whatnot and note that clearly that that's what's happening. And then it's equally important to note whether there is an intention to say something or do something that will manifest that negative judgment. You know, destructive criticism or a slighting comment or something like that. So that's ultimately where the freedom, where the peace of mind lies. It's seeing that unwholesome thought arise and just seeing it for what it is, seeing its impersonal nature, seeing that that's not who you are. I'm not a terrible person who's always judging others. I am a person being mindful of the arising of critical judgments in the mind, which is hugely different, coming from a totally different place. Good question. Thank you so much. Okay. David?
I was kind of wondering, from a practical tact, between noble doubt and skeptical doubt, which one, you know, I can trust with my practice. Obviously, the noble doubt has a sort of shimmer.
Yes.
Hope. But the skeptical doubt, I guess, in my experience, is not trustworthy because it's not very honest. It's actually more of a prejudiced disbelief. You know, there's an assertion. And it's actually not an ego, it's more of a shadow thing. You know, and the more I try to use like ego tools like intellect or discipline, the more the ego grows, the more the shadow grows with it, and
yes.
Starts saying, to hell with you.
Yes.
Tear you down.
Working with skeptical doubt. And the question also is helpful as a way of reminding us that all the objects of doubt are related. Because as you encounter skeptical doubt of the teachings, right, that almost inevitably slops over into skeptical doubt of your own capabilities as well, okay? And say, well, you know, I'm not smart enough to be able to judge, you know, I'm sufficiently, if the Dharma is correct, and I'm not really well enough attuned to judge when I'm on an ego trip and when I'm not. I'm not well enough attuned, my judgment isn't good enough to know when I'm being hosed and when the Dharma's for real. And so you have doubt in your own judgment of your own ability to judge what's true and what's not with regard to the Dharma. One of the important starting points for me in working with skeptical doubt, once it's recognized, as you correctly point out, is to not do anything about it, except to observe it. What is its nature? What are the kinds of thoughts that it's producing? And then asking yourself, are those thoughts true? Okay. Ajahn Chah said the answer to that should always be, not sure. Not sure. You know. He talks of his teachings about the wisdom of uncertainty. You know, that the Dharma is provisional. Maybe so. You know, ahipasiko, abide contemplating the possibility that this is true. Okay. The Buddha taught the Dharma, but the Dharma is meaningless insofar as how you live your life until and unless you get to the point where to some degree or another, the Dharma becomes yours, until it becomes your Dharma, until it becomes the truth of your lived experience. When skeptical doubt arises, it's important to remember that doubt with that much power doesn't come out of nowhere. Where it comes from is in response to the strengthening of mindfulness and the ability of mindfulness to begin to inquire, to bore into the question of whether, in fact, there is a permanent self. So when you feel that happening, that's what's going on. And to some, and even though it feels difficult and you know, you feel you're being judgmental or you're being skeptical of the Dharma, to the extent it's possible for you to recognize that dynamic for what it is, it can be helpful. If you come to the point where you conclude, you know, I really don't know whether this stuff is true or not, or I don't know if this path is right for me, and you feel that you've come to the point where those thoughts are so strong that it precludes you from being able to practice, okay, then stop practicing and see what happens. Just experience, okay, what if I believe that? What if I take that belief on? What are the consequences of doing that? And look at how those consequences play out in your life relative to how you were before. Okay. And in some cases, the decision to not battle it, to not try to stifle it, you know, is all that is really needed to disempower it. I was at a satsang with Ram Dass many, many years ago in the early 1970s when he'd recently come back from Asia, and he was all about his guru. He was telling his guru stories all the time, you know. We have these 6 or 7 hour satsangs and music, and he was telling one guru story after another, and finally, some guy toward the back of the room says, "To hell with your guru." Shout out, crucify him. And so he was kind of this, you know, spiritual heckler. And so people were turned to, people, these bhaktis, they were really into Yaram Dasa, they turned to this guy and started to give him dirty looks and tell him to get lost and whatnot. And what Ram Dass said was, to the extent you are angered by that man's words, to that extent do you harbor doubts about what I'm saying. So it's an opportunity for you to look at your attachment to my teachings. So if you got some guy in the back of the room saying, "To hell with the Buddha," crucify him, right? Look at that. Look at that. It's the antidote to attachment to views. And we've run way over time. I want to thank everyone for paying attention to what we were up to tonight. Please take just a moment to settle into your sitting posture once more.
Bhavatu sabha mangalam, rakantu sabha devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you.
Have a safe journey home. See you next week.